WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me is Michael Korda, who is the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster and is the author of the best-selling Male Chauvinism, Power, and Success. There was a time in his life when Michael Korda worried that he'd never be a success and that he'd always be in the shadow of his notorious extended family. The most famous family member was his uncle, Sir Alexander Korda, the Jewish-Hungarian film tycoon whose reputation was made in London and Hollywood with films like The Thief of Baghdad, The Scarlet Pimpernel, and The Third Man. He made and lost fortunes he even bought and later sold United Artists. He brought his two brothers into the film industry, Zoltan. His brother, Michael Korda's uncle, was a director, now remembered for movies like The Four Feathers and Cry the Beloved Country. Vincent Korda, my guest's father, was basically shanghaied by Sir Alexander Korda from his career as a painter to become an art director for the Korda movies. This actually all seems like the possible subject of a Hollywood movie. A movie about the Kordas has never been made as yet, but Michael Korda has written the story of his family in a new book, called Charmed Lives, A Family Romance. Charmed Lives is published by Random House. Michael Korda, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
You're from a pretty wealthy family, and the stories that are told about wealthy families are usually pretty polar. They're either one thing or another. The one thing is that you come away saying, oh, it's wonderful and magical to have a lot of money, and you live a wonderful life if you do. The other moral from the second half of the stories is, money's good to have, but it buys a life of decadence and lost dreams and unfulfilled promises and bitter truths. Are either of those two morals applicable to your family story?
No. Well, I think that that's putting it really on the wrong basis. First of all, under any circumstances, it is always better to be rich. I think the Duchess of Windsor once said, in a phrase which is engraved somewhere in the back of my lumberyard of a mind, you can never be too rich or too thin. And I'm not sure that I actually agree with the second, but I certainly agree with the first. Let me say that, first of all, one caveat to what you say. I never regarded the Kordas as rich. Now, that's because the Kordas in reality were not rich in terms of having enormous amounts of money. They lived as if they had enormous amounts of money. They invested millions and millions of pounds and dollars of other people's money in their own motion picture companies. But they were not multi-millionaire proprietors in that sense. They were, of course, by the standards of any ordinary right-thinking person, lavishly, incredibly, disgustingly, flamboyantly, and extremely rich. I would be the first to agree. Talk about 120-foot yachts, we had 120-foot yachts. Talk about Rolls Royces, we had Rolls Royces. Villas, houses, caviar, jewels, diamonds, anything you name it, yes. In that sense, rich. But my problem, you see, is that having been brought up that way, I assumed that that was natural. And because the court has made a great profession of simplicity and democratic idealism and in general, anti-elitism and anti-snobbery, particularly with their children, my impression was that we were poor and that other people were very much richer, right? And just as when I was a child in California, of course, we went out to California in the 1940s so that Alex could make that Hamilton woman with Larry Olivier and Vivian Leigh and a number of other reasons. And, of course, the moment he arrived in California, he got divorced, which is what happens to people when they get to California because it's in the air somehow. And no sooner had he arrived there than he discovered that my aunt Merle O'Brien was having an affair with Lucien Ballard, who was living in the gardener's cottage of Alex's own house. And suddenly, and the same thing happens to my father, and we all end up living in bungalows in the Beverly Hills Hotel. And I thought genuinely that poor people lived in small bungalows in the Beverly Hills Hotel and that rich people lived in large bungalows in the Beverly Hills Hotel. But it didn't occur to me that this, all the social classes were not encompassed in the guests of the Beverly Hills Hotel, you see. So I was never under the impression that we were rich. I was under the impression that we were poor. And also, because the Korda family were in the entrepreneurial motion picture business in a very large way, all three of them, has to be said that we had the dubious blessing of a mixture of flamboyant extravagance combined with the maximum amount of insecurity. So that you were never quite sure, because the Kordas were so reluctant to talk about money, as to whether life would be the same tomorrow. Right now, for children, of course, it's very hard to take, because children, I've long since come to discover, prefer consistency to anything else. They would rather be poor always than sometimes rich and sometimes poor. So all of those factors taken together, I don't know that it was not until later in life that I realized that we'd been rich. And allowing for all of that, I would go one step further and point out that in general, my belief would be that whereas money cannot buy happiness, and I agree with it. I mean, Alex himself was rich, or lived like a rich man all his life, but was not a conspicuously happy man. I'd still rather be rich. I think there's a great deal to be said for possessions.
What about notoriety? You were also the son of a notorious family, known on a number of continents. Did you have that impression when you were growing up? How aware were you of the reputations of your family?
I think I was quite aware of it, though once again it seemed to me perfectly natural. It's only looking back on it that it seems to me unnatural.
Sure, I mean, I used to go to the cleaners, and the woman behind the cleaners used to say, "You're Ann Gross's kid, aren't you?" And I figured, well, then, you know, the neighborhood knows my mom. That might have been the way you experienced it around the world.
No. I wasn't quite that naive. No. I mean, I got to the point where when I was an adolescent, I really did hate the sound of somebody saying to me, you know, Korda, I know your uncle Alex, what a wonderful man. And all those Central Europeans saying, you know, Korda, I knew your uncle, your father, your other uncle, your whole family. I hated that. Now I don't hate it anymore, of course, but then it doesn't happen that much anymore because it's all some time ago. But there was a time when I found that extremely difficult to put up with. But notoriety, I'm, of course, less sure that that's necessary. You know, I think there's an awful lot to be said for money, but I don't think there's a great deal to be said for notoriety.
You were the child in the family, and my impression was from your book that there were times when being the child was really important to the family, when being the child was kind of an encumbrance for the family, and you seem to have gotten shifted around quite a bit depending on who was really needing you and who really wasn't needing you at the time.
Well, I'm not so sure it's such a question of need. I think that the complication lies in the fact that the Kordas were extravagantly patriarchal without in any way having the least sense of what to do with or for children. There was, again, one of those unfortunate and paradoxical combinations. There was an enormous amount of love floating around the Korda family, I think, but without any understanding of need, affection, or propinquity. I mean, the Kordas loved their children, perhaps loved them too much or in the wrong ways, but hadn't the slightest desire to be anywhere near their children, or the slightest interest in being anywhere near their children, or the slightest feeling of what to say to their children if, which God forbid, they got near them. Now, that they loved them was unquestionable. I mean, they loved them to the point of suffocation, but they didn't know what to do with them when they were around them, right? So their basic instinct was to move them as far away as possible, you know, to shunt them off to mothers or to schools, to universities, but away. So one had a curious kind of combination, again, of suffocating closeness together with complete apartness.
Were there things when you were a child that you swore you would or wouldn't do when you became an adult?
Well, probably. But needless to say, as all parents do, I've simply repeated the past in a different form. I mean, I don't believe that that kind of thing ever changes. But I also feel that what is significant about the Korda milieu, about the entire Korda mishpucha, is that if you look back on it, although it's full of tragedies. I mean, in Alex's case, this his divorce from Maria, the great silent movie star, his failure in Hollywood, his coming to England, his marriage to Merle Oberon and the failure of that marriage, the failure of his third marriage, gloom, bad heart, desperation, death, you know, not to speak of everything that goes on around Zolly's life and everything that goes on around my father's life. And yet, when you look back on it, it is full of great, hilarious, funny anecdotes and a tremendous sense of excitement and drama and things happening. And one of the things that gives me pleasure, I think, is that by waiting until my mid-40s to write Charmed Lives, that I think I've been able to make it an unbitter book without in any way concealing the fact that this is not an ordinary happy family.
I think the first movies people see when they're young have a certain magic surrounding it, because seeing a movie on a big screen is unlike anything else, particularly when you're 2 or 3 or 4. Your family made a lot of movies. What were your first movie-going experiences like, the first times you saw images projected onto a screen?
Well, I think probably the first movie that I remember seeing made by the Cordas, and it may well have been the first movie I ever saw in its entirety, was The Thief of Baghdad, which is an incredible movie to be in as a child, because it really was the Star Wars of 1940. Wonderful movie. We played it again in New York, as a matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago, and had standing room only, and tremendous numbers of children, aged, I would guess, between 5 and 16 or 17, well, 14 or 15 anyway, who were entranced by the movie, absolutely entranced. And yet you're talking of a movie that is now, God help me, almost 40 years old. And it's just as good today as it ever was. That kind of thing is quite remarkable. A lot of what Alex did, without, I think, consciously having set out to do it, works terribly well with children. Children love, for example, Elephant Boy. Children adore Sanders of the River, Four Feathers, Drums, Thief of Baghdad, Jungle Book. Now, they were not intended as children's movies by any stretch of the imagination, but the fact of the matter is they are movies of high adventure, romance, and somewhat noble purpose, but not in any obvious way, and movies which contain not only adventure, but animals, people, heroes, jungles, and so forth. They're perfect for children. Absolutely perfect. And that's because there was something essentially childlike about Alex's fascination with things. You know, he himself, and I think it's what made him different from people like Harry Cohn or Louis B. Mayer, retained something of the child all his life.
For me, when I first saw movies, it was absolutely mysterious to me. I had no idea how these images were made or why they were there or who got them to move. You had some access to the behind-the-scenes end of this. You grew up knowing actors and actresses and knowing the people who make movies. Did that change the magic of it at all for you? Did it make it any more or less magical, do you think?
I don't think so. But though what you say is rather interesting, because I would have thought, how old are you?
28.
Well, then you'd have grown up in the television era.
Oh, but I remember very vividly the first movie I saw.
Oh, I understand that, but why would you have thought that...
Oh, the size of it.
It was the size of it. Oh, you accepted television as natural.
But because that's right.
but movies, because they were larger, seemed unnatural.
Yeah, and you walked into a place... It's an interesting phenomenon. The first movie I saw, I walked in the middle of the movie, so I didn't have a sense of, well, first the lights go out, first you see where you are, mm-hmm. then the lights mm-hmm. go out, then the movie starts. So you walk in, and suddenly it's dark, and there's this eerie music playing, and mm-hmm. people are getting eaten alive by octopuses and underwater monsters and struggling.
Yes, you're quite right. You see, television doesn't inculcate fantasy. Television purports to be reality. And even when television is done in fictional form, it is projected as if it were a documentary or a piece of reality. Now, as we all know, the reality is as full of bilge and as phony as anything else on television. But the fact of the matter is, whatever television projects, it projects it as real. Whereas whatever the movies project, even if it's real, is projected as fantasy. And that's the real distinction between them, which it seems to me almost nobody understands. It is why you cannot put movies on television and get the same effect. It is not because it's a small screen. It's because the machine itself begins from a different purpose or sense of purpose. And this is really very important, I think, to understanding what movies are about, is understanding that movies are basically fantasy. You know, Irving Thalberg was reputed to be the greatest genius in Hollywood at one time and was in charge of production at MGM under Louis B. Mayer. And Irving Thalberg got his start in a very funny way, which is typical of the motion picture business. You know, there are certain epochal discoveries in motion pictures. The first great epochal discovery was the sprocket hole, oddly enough. Because if you think of it, before Edison had invented the notion of putting sprocket holes on the film, the whole business didn't work until you put the sprocket holes on the film. And the first major motion picture ever made, Squaw Man, directed by Cecil B. DeMille in God knows when, 1911, failed because his film had different size sprocket film holes from the machines in New York. So though he was the first to discover California as a place to make a movie, by the way, it's the first movie ever made in Los Angeles, and he was sending back cables saying, hey, this place is great, it's sunny all the time, it's lousy, but it's sunny and we're staying in a cheap hotel. But one of the epochal discoveries was Irving Thalberg's, which was that during the period in which sound tended to revolve around music in movies as opposed to conversation, that interim period, there was a very simple rule, which was that you had to explain on screen where the music was coming from, so that if there was a violin background to a love scene, the director would shoot to a string orchestra in one corner of a restaurant, let us say, who would be playing da 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 da, and every once in a while he would shift back to it because it was thought necessary to explain the presence of music, right? Then they decided that it would be better if you explained it but hit it slightly. So they put palm trees in front of the orchestra, and the director would shoot to the palm trees, and you would see a movement of hands and violin bows from behind the palm trees, and then that would explain where the music was coming from, you see. Then they began to take away one or two of the palm trees, and Irving Thalberg got his reputation by being the first man in the history of motion pictures to say, I can't swear on the radio, I guess, to say, screw the palm trees. And he took all the palm trees off, and he just had the music without explaining where it came from, right? He was the first person who, when there was a bedroom scene, instead of going through a lot of tedious garbage to explain that there were musicians downstairs or whatever, simply said, put music on the soundtrack and people will accept it. And they did, right? The improbable thing of two people being in their apartment. Whereas up until Irving Thalberg, if there was going to be music for their love scene, you would have had to have the director close on the hand picking up the phonograph record and turning the phonograph on, and then the music starts. Irving Thalberg was the first person to say, why bother? Have them come into the room and violins swell up from behind. And it worked. Now, these epochal moments in the movie business come out of an understanding that it is a fantasy business. The reason Alex was good at it was that Alex was a fast learner about fantasy. He was a poor Jewish boy from Hungary who was a very bright student, but with a high, kind of romantic Luftmensch quality to him, and always, to the end of his life, kind of bohemian Künstler aspect to him, however successful he was, who wandered to Budapest with the thought of becoming a journalist to support his family, became a film journalist because that was all he could find, became a motion picture director because anybody could in those days, and parlayed that into a vast fortune and fame and celebrity and a knighthood in England, but never took it totally seriously. And for him, the fantasy was as much the transforming of himself into an elegant figure named Sir Alexander Korda instead of a poor Jewish boy from Pusta Trapazza named Kelm de Chandor, that he understood almost from the beginning that what the movies were about were that kind of self-fulfilling fantasy. You know, that's why it's such an extraordinary business. I mean, Leslie Howard was born in Hungary, and his name was Lajos Horváth. He moved to Germany, became a German actor, and called himself, I think, Lajos Steiner, and then moved from Hungary to England and became a perfect English gentleman under the name of Leslie Howard, right? And everybody in the world today accepts Leslie Howard as a perfect English gentleman, except that he happens to be a Hungarian Jew named Lajos Horváth. And indeed, I've forgotten his real name, but I was not surprised, but fascinated the other day to discover that Douglas Fairbanks was a Hungarian Jew,
mm-hmm.
right? But the fact is you could go out into the movie business and not only make fantasy, but live fantasy. And that, of course, was the wonderful thing about it for people who went into it, like Alex, is that if you were a quick learner, you could become anything you wanted to become. And in the movie business, it's accepted. It's accepted because it is fantasy and make-believe. And it interests me terribly what you say about television, because it happens to be exactly what I believe the difference is between these two media, which very few people really understand. Is that one media is geared to reality and one media is geared to fantasy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Korda, and his new book is called Charmed Lives. It's a book about his family, the Korda family. I think it was Orson Welles who said something like, I wish they would make Alexander Korda a cardinal so that we could only have to kiss his ring.
That's quite true.
Yes.
That's quite true. Orson can be difficult.
How did Alexander Korda get along with most of the actors and actresses that he worked with?
Well, Alex was a born manipulator and a man of overwhelming charm. So that he got along with most of them extremely well, bearing in mind that nothing in life is perfect. I mean, he often quarreled with Orson. But then Orson was a very difficult man, you know, because Orson is more than a great actor. Orson is also a very accomplished director, though I've always thought a rather tricky one. And a very interesting producer, though I've always thought one who was unreliable and prone to bankruptcy. All the same, there's a kind of universal genius aspect to Orson, which makes him an uncomfortable prospect as an actor in a motion picture, because rightly or wrongly, Orson is under the impression that he either did or should have written the script, done the direction, done the lighting, done the decorations, produced it, and if possible, played all the other parts. So Orson would be a rare exception, and it's certainly true that Alex and Orson, though they were very fond of each other, quarreled constantly. On the other hand, his relationships were exceedingly good with Larry Olivier and Vivian Leigh. Complex because Alex was kind of, when Larry was interested elsewhere, Vivian Leigh's lover, a relationship which is hard to describe. Actually, I don't think it's such a hard relationship to describe. That exactly describes it. And very fond of Vivian, which actually I suppose goes without saying. He got along extremely well with Ralph Richardson, who did all his films for Alex. And extremely well with Lawton until Lawton's really crazed period of self-hatred and fear and inability to perform that followed Henry VIII in 1933 and 4, when Alex had a serious breach with Lawton. But before that, he did very well with Lawton and probably, I think, directed Lawton better than anybody ever directed Lawton. So I would think Alex got along very well with most of the people who worked for him. He had a certain reputation for ruthlessness, but then he was a very ruthless man.
And that's why he had the reputation.
Yes.
How did he decide to take on a film? The impression that one gets nowadays is that before anyone decides to produce a movie, it has to have incredible blockbuster box office potential, and that you look at demographics and statistics and try to analyze, this is my impression, of try to, you know, come to some decision about whether the movie will reach enough people to not only break even but make a handsome profit. Things were maybe different in those days. technically less sophisticated?
Less
precise?
Well, no. The technology of movie making was slightly less sophisticated.
Audience predicting is what I mean.
Of course. Well, first of all, let me say that what you say is not altogether wrong, except that the main difference between movies then and movies now is that movies now are dramatically more expensive. Dramatically more expensive. A $2 million movie was a very big movie as late as the early 1950s.
Well, even when Cleopatra came out, how much was that? That was a national scandal for a month.
$15-20 million. But $15-20 million, even allowing for inflation, would be nothing on a movie today. The movie technology has become so big, and the movie is no longer financed as they used to be financed. So by giving shares of it away and overpaying, it becomes very expensive. So that's the first big change, is it's become a very big, expensive money business. The second big change is that there is no big change, because the truth of the matter is, yes, everybody goes through the most elaborate contortions now to try and determine what the marketability of a motion picture is, and exactly the same number of movies fail now as failed before. I mean, basically, in movie making, 90% of the movies made lose money. The other 10% make so much money that they pay for everything else and make it an extremely successful business. Now, that has been true since the days when Cecil B. DeMille first went out to Los Angeles and said, all right, let's shoot The Squaw Man here, because why not? It remains true today. It was masked for some years from being seen as true by the fact that the movie companies, for a very long period of time, were able to own the theaters and the distribution companies. Therefore, they were able to make it appear as if most of the movies were profitable. But all they were doing was buying the unprofitable movies from themselves, so that the amount of money they lost on the unprofitable movies were incapable of being traced, or were passed along to the distributors, or were passed along to the theater owners. But it was always true, even in those days, that a very small number of movies made it a profitable business. And this is still true today. So I don't think that all the research in the world has changed the fact that the same schmucks are still making the same bad movies, except that they're different people making different movies. But it's the same thing. The same idiots are sitting in the polo lounge of the Beverly Hills Hotel, listening to exactly the same kind of ninth-rate ideas from fourth-rate people, and investing other people's money in large quantities in them to come out with nothing, exactly as they were doing in 1920 or 1930. And what is the difference? You know, the girls have different clothes on, and there's air conditioning.
Boy, this summer there wasn't air conditioning here.
This summer there wasn't even. Then they're back to the 1930s, right? The guys tend to be younger and fitter now because fitness is in. But actually, fitness was in the 20s, too. They were big polo players and tennis players in those days. It's just that they wore white flannels. Nothing changes in the movie business, and there's no reason why it should. If Alex were alive today, he would make the same successes and the same mistakes that he would have made 20 years ago.
So how did he basically decide to take on or not to take on a movie?
Instinct. Right? And Alex's instincts were sometimes very good and sometimes very bad. But instinct. And also, he took on as movies what Alex himself thought interested him.
You said that you thought he never really got to comprehend American taste.
Well, that, mind you, would not be something you could say of Alex alone. I don't think that Alex ever truly understood the differentness of this country.
From England?
No, from Europe.
From Europe.
England, he didn't understand either, but it didn't matter. He figured you could fake England, and he was right. It's a small country. And you could make European-type pictures in England with an English background, and they'll come out just fine, and they'll play in Europe, and they'll play in England, and maybe even in America. No, he understood England, all right, perfectly, and he was smart to stay there and become a knight there and make that his base of operations. What he did not understand about America is that it is a very much more complex country than England and very much different from Europe. And that, I think, tripped him up. Now, sometimes he managed to make things work in America. For example, The Private Lives of Henry VIII worked in America very well, precisely because it's exactly the kind of movie that is represented today by Masterpiece Theater. And could probably be done on Masterpiece Theater today in a slightly different way, very successfully. Thief of Baghdad worked over here very well because, by luck, I think more than by design, Alex happened to hit on the American passion for fantasy and child movies and for Disney and The Wizard of Oz, right? And in an improbable way, because Alex didn't like any of those things, he managed to make a movie which absolutely hit that particular nerve, which, as we all know, once hit, showers money down on you like nothing you've ever seen. I mean, look at Disney and look at Wizard of Oz. He hit it with The Third Man, a movie which worked as well in America as it did anywhere in the world. And I would guess probably that Hamilton Woman with Larry Olivier and Vivian Leigh did very well in America because it's a romance. I mean, it's Wuthering Heights in uniform. But those are, by and large, exceptions. Most of the time, Alex's films work best in England and Europe. And I'm not sure that Alex ever really truly understood this market. I don't think very many European filmmakers do.
Mm-hmm. Still. How did he get along with the big studio owners in America?
Well, studio owners, you know, not too many people actually owned studios. Studio bosses is, I think, what you really mean.
Okay.
The studios were mostly owned by public corporations. I say public in the sense of being public shares, you understand. Well, you know, Alex had a love-hate relationship with most of those people, and I knew most of those people when I was a child. And they would also, you know, they mustn't be summed up together. One of the things you have to bear in mind is that they were all different and their circumstances were different. Louis B. Mayer was a very different man from Harry Cohn, and Harry Cohn was a very different man from Jack Warner. Jack Warner was so mean that nobody came to his funeral, which is very rare in Hollywood. But Joe Schenck, who controlled Lowe's, actually controlled Louis B. Mayer. And, you know, there were layers like that. And Alex got along reasonably well with most of them, largely because he was an exotic, talented foreigner who seemed to have backing of his own in Europe and to have available to him backing of his own in America as well when he wanted it. Therefore, he was too big to be crushed, but too small to be treated as a rival and therefore mangled and killed. And as a result, he tended to get along very well with them as these things go. I mean, nobody got along well, really, with Louis B. Mayer, you know. Louis B. Mayer was a very difficult man. I remember Doris Sherry once telling me that when he went to work for MGM as the bright young hope to succeed Irving Thalberg, that one of the things he had asked LB to guarantee was that there would be no MGM executives in the screening rooms during the time that Dory was showing Rushes. So at one point, when he's making his films, he looks at the back of the screening room, and Eddie Mannix, who was kind of one of L.B. Mayer's hatchet men, is sitting in the back and clearly doesn't like the Rushes and is expressing that forcefully. So Dory rushes up to L.B., and says, "I've got to speak to you." And LB has him ushered into his throne room and says, "What's the matter, Dory, my boy?" And Dory Sherry says, "Well, you know, you promised me you wouldn't have any of your people in my screening room. And Eddie Mannix is sitting in my screening room. I don't want it." And Louis B. Mayer says, in indignation, he says, "Oh," he says, "that swine," he says, do you think, "that I would have gone back on my word to you and sent Eddie Mannix down to spy on your movies?" And Dory says, though that's exactly what he does think, of course. He says, "Absolutely not, LB. That's why." But he said, "I am glad you did so," he said, "because I feel towards you as I would feel towards my son. I feel that I am a father to you, Dory. And just to show how I feel, we're going to send for Eddie Mannix right now." So they send for Eddie Mannix, and Eddie Mannix, who's a man in his 50s, a vice president of MGM, a man who probably even in those days before taxes had ate everything up, was making a couple of $100,000 a year, plus God knows what and what he could steal. Very substantial guy, in other words, comes in and says, "You sent for me, LB." And LB says, "You bet I did, Eddie, he said. I told you, did I not to sit in on this fine young man's screenings. And Mannix says, that's right, I'll be it. And he said, and did you break my word to this fine young man? And Mannix says, well, yes, I'll be. Why did you do that, Albie says. And Mannix says, well, because I figured you want me to spy on what he was doing, Albie. Albie says, well, you were wrong, Eddie, he said, because I trust this fine and honorable young man who is the most talented young man we've ever had on this lot. And Eddie, I want you to beg his apology. So Eddie Mannix says to Dory Sherry, Dory, listen, I'm awfully sorry. It's never going to happen again. Dory says, fine. LB says, it's not enough, Eddie. I want you to get down on your knees and ask for his forgiveness. And Eddie Mannix creaks down onto his knees and says, I hope you'll forgive me, Dory. And Dory, by now very embarrassed, says, you know, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. And LB says, it's still not enough. Eddie, I want you to kiss Dory's shoe. And Eddie Mannix takes Dory's shoe, so help me God, and kisses it. And Dory's overcome and says, LB, this is awful. This is awful. I cannot stand here and see another human being humiliated in this way. And LB turns on him with eyes as cold as a pair of fishes on a slab and says, well, you'd better learn, because out here you do it or it'll be done to you. Now, you're talking about people who really were monsters, you see. Alex was not a monster. He could live with those people. He could manipulate in between them. He could use them. He could amuse them. They could amuse him. They came to dinner. But he never allowed himself to be put in a place where LB, for example, or Harry Cohn, or Zanuck could control him. Because he knew, having grown up in that business for 30 or 40 years, that is like cutting your own throat.
You think he would have been able to make it in the film industry the way it is today?
Oh, sure, because it's more independent. Though he would have been his own self, whatever he did. But yeah, I don't think anybody's ever done justice to the madness and the craziness and the power hunger and the lavishness and the grotesque, bizarre cruelty of that world. I mean... Nobody has ever done justice to it. Nobody. I remember Max Reinhardt's son, Gottfried Reinhardt, wonderful man, once worked for MGM when his father was living in Hollywood, and he once went to L.B. Mayer for a raise, and he said, you know, L.B., now my father's very ill and I need more money. You know, you promised me a raise 6 months ago and I never got it. And L.B., who always was very avuncular, particularly when he was being evasive, said, Gottfried, he said, my boy, you're right. He said, you're absolutely right. I promised you a raise 6 months ago, he said. And I meant it. He said, I absolutely mean it. You are a hard worker and you deserved it, he said. But look at it this way. We have here a very big studio at MGM. And by the very nature of our business, some of our people are vastly overpaid. And if we are to keep our business going, we must therefore underpay some of our people to make up for the ones we overpay. And every evening, I put in a long day's work, and every evening I go downstairs, and I get into the limousine, and I'm tired, and I tell the chauffeur back to Bel Air, and I lean back, and I close my eyes, and I say to myself, as I review everything that's happened in the studio in the day, I say to myself, there's Gottfried Reinhardt. He's one of our hardworking people who's underpaid. I like Gottfried Reinhardt, and my advice to you is, Gottfried, keep it that way. Now, Alex had the same kind of spirit. You know, I remember Alex when Ann Todd, he had promised her a role in a film, and he gave it to somebody else. And Ann Todd, who was a very close friend of Alex's, indeed may well have been more than a close friend to him, rushed into Alex's office in tears and fury and said, Alex, how could you do that? Did you not promise me that part? And Alex said, absolutely, he said, I promised you absolutely that part. And she said, and you have given it to somebody else. Why? And Alex looked at her and he said, taking his hands and putting it around her shoulder, he said, Anne, because we are such close friends that I knew if I betrayed you, you would forgive me. And of course, he was right. It's like that story about Ralph Richardson quarreling with Alex. They were very dear friends. And Alex had done something that Ralph was furious about. And Alex went in to scream and shout at Ralph. And Alex is sitting there saying, you're right. Ach, Ralph, you're right. You're right. Ralph, I feel so badly about it. Ralph. And Ralph is gradually kind of running down because Alex will never kind of contradict him. And suddenly Alex stops Ralph and looks down at Ralph's feet and he says, Ralph, tell me. He said, where did you get those wonderful shoes? I would give anything in my life to own such a wonderful pair of shoes. And, of course, by that time, he completely disarmed Ralph. So that kind of ability Alex had on a certain equal scale to Mayer or to Cohn or to anybody, right? And so among them, though he was not as big as they were, he could survive among them. He was as tough as they were. He was as shrewd as they were. After all, he took United Artists away from Goldwyn and from Mary Pickford and from Charlie Chaplin, which is no mean feat. And without putting a penny of his own money into it, right? I mean, without one penny to invest in United Artists, Alex came in as a favor to them to sit on the board of directors, and 3 years later walked away with United Artists. You know, I mean, it is not for nothing that they used to say in Hollywood, among other things, the Hungarian recipe for an omelet is first steal 12 eggs. And the other one. And the other one was, which was equally good. There are two other ones, actually. Obviously, this is the famous one. If you have a Hungarian for a friend, you don't need an enemy. And the third one was, a Hungarian and a Romanian will both sell you their mother, but a Hungarian will deliver. There's no question that in that world, one of Alex's prime benefits was being Hungarian, because he had the tremendous charm that is endemic to Hungarians. It's the Hungarian national weapon, and also the Hungarian national vice and disease. On the other hand, he also had the Hungarian ruthless sense of how to manipulate people, and the Hungarian proverbial dishonesty, which is always concealed in Hungary by charm. In Hungary is one of the few countries in the world you can go to, unlike France, where everybody frowns and cheats you, you know, because you're a dirty American or a dirty English or a dirty something. Whatever it is, if you're not French, you're a dirty something and they cheat you. And that's the way France is. And I love France and I love the French, but it's the way it is, right? And in Germany, they hate you, but they don't cheat you. In fact, they hate you more because, being honest, they're not going to cheat you. But Hungary is one of those countries where everybody smiles at you. Everybody has a tremendous... I wish we were on television so I could do it, but everybody goes, ah, welcome, welcome. Welcome to Transylvania. But behind that, they're cheating you, right? And that's the Hungarian national image, unfortunately, for better or for worse. I'm not saying to all those listeners out there who are about to plant a pipe bomb in my apartment as a token from the Hungarian liberation movement, I'm not saying that they aren't also, you know, politically conscious, wonderful heroes and so forth. But the fact is, the Hungarian reputation in the world is based on that. And Alex had that quality, but alleviated by such tremendous charm that Alex could cheat you and you would walk away from it grateful. In fact, you might turn back and ask if he would like something else. Right? Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful man. My father had it to the same degree. It's a very special talent.
Do you see a lot of comparisons now between what's happening within the movie industry and what's happening in the publishing industry? I should mention, for those of you just joining us, my guest is Michael Korder, and his new book, Charmed Lives, is about the Korder family. Michael Korder is also editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster. So you know both of those industries real well.
Well, I would say that the changes in the movie business are more dramatic than those in the book publishing industry, but I would say they're roughly the same. They're roughly the same. The inflation of prices, so that everything has become hideously expensive. I don't talk just in terms of retail prices, because that's inevitable. Of course, books are expensive. Shoes are expensive. Cheeseburgers are expensive. I mean, why shouldn't books be expensive too? But in terms of the prices that are being made from certain kinds of books, that's very much like the movie industry, you know, where suddenly Jaws grosses $400 million and Star Wars grosses $500 million. And now you've got, you know, Judy Krantz getting, whatever it was, $3.7 million for the paperback rights of one novel, or Tom Wolfe getting $1.1 million for a movie sale, and Gay Talese getting $2.5 million for the movie rights to his book. I mean, you're getting big prices, but only for a very small number of people. Again, it's become like Hollywood. You know, Brando gets $1 million a day. Redford gets $1 million a day. So-and-so gets $1 million a script or $5 million to direct a movie. But there are maybe only 25 of those people and everybody else is starving, right? Right? And that's become like, the book publishing industry has become like that. You know, Irving Wallace makes $5 million a year, you know, but 30 writers, other writers who would have made a decent living 10 years ago are now on welfare because there's nothing between big successes and total nothing. That's one aspect which has become very much like Hollywood. The other aspect that's become very much like Hollywood is that none editor-publisher people now run the publishing companies, just the way that the movie companies are now run by people who have never had anything to do with the movies before. They have been lawyers, agents, accountants, mafia hitmen, but they have never actually been in a movie studio before. You take David Beagleman, apart from the fact that he goes around forging checks. Actually, he's not the first person who was a Hollywood motion picture studio boss who did that kind of thing, but the fact that what's remarkable about Beagleman is not that. What's remarkable about Beagleman is the guy was an agent, right? I mean, he spent, his career was made making deals over the telephone for his clients. Now he's running a major studio. David Beagleman has never seen a film made, right? So what you've got the same phenomenon in book publishing, where the book publishing is now being run, not as everybody says, by accountants. That might actually be rather good. But it's being run by people who have been lawyers, who have been financial types, but more involved in negotiations and deal-making. And I think that in that sense, yes, there's a great similarity between the two industries. In some ways, that's going to be very lucky for some people. A lot of people, it's going to be very unhappy for.
Well, a lot of the book and film companies are owned by the same people.
Yeah, but that doesn't really add up to very much. That looks on the outside as if that's either an interesting infraction of the antitrust laws or as if it should be a terrific machine for making money. It ignores a basic fact of human nature. Nobody in a movie corporation wants to buy something that's owned by a division that's in its own corporate complex, right? Because if I were to phone Paramount and we have linked Simon and Schuster and Paramount and say, I've got a terrific story here, they'd say, yeah, send it in the pouch and maybe we'll read it, because it's coming from inside. If, on the other hand, I were on the outside and said, I've got a terrific story here, somebody would say, I'll fly out to New York tomorrow and read it, right? Don't go away. I'll buy you lunch at 21, because it's coming from the outside. What comes from the inside doesn't matter. You know what I mean? It's like in long-term marriages where if the wife says, gee, the tree outside is falling down, the husband says, yes, dear, I'll have another egg. Crash, right? You don't listen to what's inside. You listen to what's outside. And so most of these collaborations do not, in fact, add up to anything very much.
Mm-hmm. It's like how hard it is for painters and musicians to get known in their own hometown and to be taken seriously where they live. Do you get depressed by trends in publishing, or do you just figure, well, it's a trend, let's make the most of it? For instance, self-help books or diet books, which is constantly a trend.
Yeah, but you see, there's some trends. Let me just point out to you that if you take diet books, that's hardly a trend.
Yeah, that's always
that's just
in.
A basic part of the American subconscious. There's always a successful diet book. Self-help books, there's always self...
Well, running books, for instance, that's only going to last for so long. It's probably peaked already.
Yeah, I'd throw those in with self-help books, basically, and health books and diet books. They're different facets of the same thing. Trends, yeah, I think trends are kind of boring. But, you know, also, if you publish for trends, you've got a business. Right? I'd rather not publish for trends and figure maybe once in a career you'll hit that book and be the publisher of Jonathan Livingston Seagull or Rod McEwen's first publisher as opposed to his second and third, and make an awful lot of money. Just by sheer statistical luck, you know, sometime down the road, maybe you'll hit a trend and be a trend setter and make a fortune. But if you start publishing for trends, you go bankrupt. better to publish because you can read it and like it and wait for a trend to happen and maybe hit you than attempt to invent and outguess trends because you can't.
So how do you decide if a book is worth taking up or not?
Well, fundamentally, it's got to be something that I like and want to publish. And I try and avoid anything which I don't like and don't want to publish. Now, I can be mousetrapped into doing all sorts of things that I later wish I hadn't done because I persuade myself that I don't like it, but it will work, or I don't like it, but it's going to be very big, or I don't like it, but it's a hot subject, or I don't like it, but the author's terrific on television. And 99% of the time, I'm wrong. If I don't like it, no matter what else, it's not going to work. I'm not setting myself up as having, you know,
wires, I like it. You mean
wires connecting
too, right?
me to the public taste. And I'm not talking about quality versus not quality. I can make mistakes. I mean, I read Judith Krantz's Scruples, and I said, you know, I think it's very commercial, but I really don't like it, and I don't see how we're going to make it work. And I offered to buy it, and they wanted a lot more money, and I said, let it go. Mistake. Except that's not to say that if I'd published Scruples, it would have worked, because mm-hmm. that's not the right attitude to bring to publishing Scruples. You know what I mean? You're going to publish Scruples, you better come in on it saying, it's terrific, it's marvelous, we're going to make it work, we're going to sell more copies than Jackie Suzanne. If you come in on it and say, it's okay, but it's not great, then it's going to be, you know, it's going to be okay and not great, and that's what's going to happen. So you have to bear that in mind, that your own enthusiasm is an important component.
How much of what finally really sells do you think is based on stuff outside of what's between the covers of the book, like really savvy promotion, good book tours, advertising in the right places, a magnetic personality behind the book?
Well, it depends on what category you're talking about. In terms of self-help books, maybe 99% of it is outside the book because all of them are full of bilge anyway and don't tell you how to do anything that you haven't been told to do before, like diet books. You know what I mean? There is no such thing as a new diet. I mean, the answer is all diet books can be encompassed in the following two sentences. Eat less, consult your doctor. There's nothing else to say to anybody, right? I mean, you can say, now the way to eat less is to eat meat or to live off avocado. But I mean, the fact of the matter is every goddamn diet book ever published is contained in two sentences. Eat less, but consult your doctor. That's it. Now, nevertheless, so I mean, 99% of that has to come from the fact that Dr. Schmutz, or whatever his name is good on the Carson show and also has, you know, a new thing, which is that if you eat one avocado a day and that's all you eat, you'll lose weight. So it's the avocado diet. And fine. If you take novels, though, it's probably the reverse. 99% is in the book. You cannot make a work of fiction successful, no matter how much money you spend advertising, promoting, and touring for the book, unless people read it and say, gee, that's exciting. Right? There's no way to do it. You cannot spend enough money.
We only have a minute or two left. I'd like to know if you think that you've applied anything of what you know as an editor to what you do as a writer, or whether those two parts of your work don't mix.
They really don't. They really don't. I have learned nothing as an editor that is helpful to me as a writer beyond a lavish amount of patience with publishers. Because as a publisher myself, I try as an author not to get upset about things. And I understand more the complexity of it. And therefore, if I go in a bookstore and they don't have a copy of my book, even though I'm there, I don't, you know, go into a corner and sob and then send two angry telegrams. I mean, I may well phone up and say, hey, look, we ought to get some books in here if we can. But I understand the complexity of the business. But in terms of actually writing a book, I don't think so, you know. I think that I can't edit my own stuff. I really can't. It's difficult enough writing it without having to edit it.